Welcome to the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast, where it's all about slashing your debt, slashing your taxes, and creating a liberated lifestyle. And now, your host, who has a vast collection of vintage DC and Marvel comic books, and ironically lives in Minnesota, where his favorite NBA team, the LA Lakers, originated, Dave Denniston.
Welcome back, my friends, to another episode of the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast. I am so excited to have a guest on here with me today. He is a physician joining us for the Physician Fireside Chat segment, and he is an author, wrote a book called Medical Student Loans that is actually going to be completely for free here shortly. He is also a blogger and talks a lot about all kinds of different stuff. So I highly recommend checking out that blog. His name is Dr. Ben White. Ben, glad to have you on the show, sir.
Thank you for having me. Happy to be here.
All right. That's like the typical radio line, right? Happy to be here. Just
totally.
Comes out.
Absolutely.
So tell us a bit about you, Ben. You're telling me beforehand you live in Dallas area. Where were you raised in? And where did you grow up?
So I was born in New York, and I kind of grew up in the Bronx for the first, 8 years of my life. Then we moved to Dallas with my family. My dad is an academic pediatric endocrinologist. And so he took a job here at Children's in Dallas. And so my family moved from New York to Dallas, quite a change. Although over the next kind of 9 years, I think I became pretty much an adopted Texan. Then I went to Harvard for undergrad in Boston, then came back to San Antonio for med school, then back to Dallas again, back home for residency and fellowship, and I'm a practicing neuroradiologist here in Dallas.
And I believe your wife is a physician as well, right?
She is. She's a psychiatrist, and she has a specialty in women's mental health, does a lot of peripartum psychiatry issues.
I think that'd be interesting to dive into that. So we'll have to talk about what it's been like having a two physician household and what that has been. Now, obviously your dad was a physician, being an endocrinologist. Tell me about kind of that influence. Did you always want to be a doctor, or what was that like for you?
No, I definitely did not want to be a doctor. I think if you'd asked me as a preteen, I was very anti-medicine, I think, in general. I think I just wanted to be, rebel as a teenager, I suppose. And so I kind of think I wanted to be, a musician or something in entertainment, because I used to play like guitar and I thought it'd be fun to do that. And then, ironically, so I met my wife in high school, actually. We're high school sweethearts.
Wow. You guys are one of the ones that made it. Wow.
We did. Yeah. So I've been dating her we've been together for 17 years, actually. I'm 34. So it's half my life now. And so, we kind of have to figure out what you want to do a little bit when you go to college, pick your major. And she kind of asked me, and I kind of gave some hedgy answers, and she kind of called me out on it. And she's like, really? And she was pre-med. I was like, I should probably just do that too, which is not a great story. Right. But when I was writing my essays for college, I kind of sat down and thought about it some more. And I realized that, medicine is one of those great fields where, it's a combination of a well-paying profession where you have the opportunity to actually have a positive impact in people's lives on a daily basis, which is a rare combination. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I picked it.
Interesting. What was your dad's reaction as you said, I want to do pre-med now?
He was very happy for me to be pre-med. He was less interested in me being a radiologist, honestly, right? Because he's a clinician. He sees patients, although he does a lot of academic stuff as well. My mother actually is a pediatrician as well. So they met during residency at Hopkins back in Baltimore, in the 70s. They were very happy for me to go into medicine. They did not mind that at all. My older brother is a historian, so he is a little bit different than me. But yeah, so that was the plan. Later on, they were like, really, radiology? People. Don't you want to see people again?
So you grew up in a household that I'm guessing did well for themselves, being two physicians. And what were your experiences with money as you grew up?
Yeah, I will say, as far as two doctor households go, we were a little bit atypical. So my mother had a kind of a private practice where she had a very flexible payment schedule, kind of like a lot of fruit baskets and edible arrangements, kind of bartering went on there. And my dad, as an academic PD endo, is kind of probably one of the very lowest paid specialties in medicine. Mm. So we had a very comfortable life. but they sent both my brother and me to private school growing up. Mm. So between, you know, that and his kind of, and they're kind of general, just not interest in kind of ostentatious stuff. We had a very normal outward appearance. You know, they basically prioritized education, prioritized time as a family. And then we kind of, you know, had a big house that was not super up to date and, you know, kind of older American mid-level cars, kind of very normal stuff. So I kind of didn't realize actually how unusual my upbringing was and how kind of fortunate I was till later on, because compared to some of my peers in school, my family seemed much less well off just because of how we spent money versus how much they made. You know what I mean?
What kind of influence do you think that had on you?
I mean, it was great, right? So I think, you know, it's very easy to kind of get on that hedonic treadmill, right? Where you want to spend more and more and more about things that are kind of more and more frivolous.
Yeah.
And so, you know, for us, it was always about family and education. And so even now, you know, that we are in a situation where, you know, we can be more comfortable in how much we spend. It's nice to know that that is not a priority for me. It's not how I grew up. And so it is easier for me to resist at least some of the marketing, the messaging that makes it hard to kind of pay yourself first.
Did they ever force you to work, you know, whether in high school or college or anything like that?
So they actually did not. And I think they always felt that, you know, school was your job and that sure. They'd rather I, you know, volunteer and do something kind of formative than take some kind of entry-level hourly job. My brother actually did work at a grocery store, kind of bagging groceries and moving carts around for a while. But it was actually something that he had wanted to do to have like his own kind of personal money. I think it was one of his forms of, you know, teenage rebellion, I guess, maybe. Didn't last very long. but yeah, I mean, I did work as a camp counselor, you know, in high school. And then in college, I did a couple, you know, odd jobs here and there. And I took an advising job that kind of paid a stipend and did stuff like that. But in high school, no, I really just did things that were interesting, which was very nice. And, you know, I think was very nice of them to not kind of force me to do that. I will say, you know, obviously you do get kind of some benefits from having that maturity from being forced to show up on time to some place and be responsible.
Yeah.
That it did take me a little bit longer probably to really fully get to. Mm. I would say, you know, when third year of medical school came around and I had to actually, you know, be at the hospital every morning, that was probably the first time in my life that I really had to have a real, you know, job-like existence where you go to bed on time and get up on time, be responsible for where you are any given moment. You know, I think it's very easy in school to kind of, you know, not do that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. Right. I mean, especially if things are going well. So I'm picturing you and your girlfriend at the time. You're in high school, you're applying to college. Did the two of you go, both of you went to Harvard, or where did she go?
So she went to Brandeis, which is a school about half an hour away in Waltham, Massachusetts. So it's very close. They actually ran a shuttle every weekend from Thursday through Sunday that would take the bus in a loop. It would go from Brandeis to Harvard Square to downtown Boston in a loop all evening into kind of late night. So we got to spend, you know, every weekend together. It was very convenient. We weren't like, you know, together every day. And then when we applied for med school, Texas has at least had a kind of match system where you would apply to whatever schools you wanted to that were part of the state. And then you would get matched to whatever school you want. Like, you know, you kind of rank them in order of how you wanted them. And then they'd have a match day, kind of like residency, where they would assign you to the school you got. But they did have some spots they would give away ahead of the match. And so when we were applying to med school, we only applied to schools in Texas because we were Texas residents and the sticker prices.
Mm.
So much better than anything else out there. And so we both kind of got interviews in San Antonio early and got acceptances before the match kind of deadline. So he said, oh, yeah, great. You know, why be in the match and have the chance of being separated? We didn't want to. Mm-hmm. So we got in there early. So we just called it a day.
And were the two of you engaged by that point? Or when did you pop the question?
I popped the question right before med school started, after we graduated college. So we actually did get in together before we were actually formally engaged.
Interesting. Wow. Big step, right? You know, it's like you're making that together and I'm sure you ended up having a lot of the same classes, right? In med school
med school was all one class basically. So, you know, all the lectures were all the same and then they would kind of break out to small groups. So back then our small groups were based on your last name. So since we got married after the first year of med school. So During the basic science years, we had different last names. So we were actually in different small groups and like different anatomy tanks and stuff like that. But we were in the same lecture. So we sat, you know, side by side for, you know, hours and hours a day. It was much more time together than we'd ever spent before.
Right? Yeah, totally. How did that impact your relationship?
It was nice, honestly. It really was.
Because you guys, you know, didn't see each other for most of the week. So like you kind of had your own separate lives in a way, right? During college, at least for part of the week. And so now you really
I think it helps that med school is just generally less interesting than college was. So I feel like, you know, anything in college, if you, when you have a serious relationship in college, sometimes it can take away from, you know, some of the kind of self-building that people and discovery people have in that time of their lives. But med school, honestly, is kind of boring. It's very tedious, a lot of facts. Mm-hmm. So at least the first couple of years are. And so I think it was nice. I'll also say that she's a lot more of a diligent worker than I am. She definitely rubbed off on me. And I'm a better person now because of her by far. And so I think having her around more made me a better student for sure.
That's awesome. The better half, right?
Absolutely. There was no doubt about it.
And so during this time, obviously there's two of you going through medical school, and it's certainly not cheap. What was your experience, each of your experiences with student loans?
So my parents paid for my college entirely. So I had never kind of borrowed anything before. I was very lucky. You know, I made extra money and kind of spent it on fun stuff for myself, you know, a new guitar here and there, kind of, you know, whatever, but I'd never been in debt before. She had some loans from college, but not a lot. And then we were both completely funding our med school. Mm-hmm. And so I went from having no debt to having lots of debt, in case basically living off student loans entirely. So, you know, every dollar we spent was a dollar we borrowed. You know, in med school, I did work in the library for a while, and I did a lot of tutoring, which kind of helped, you know, mitigate a small fraction, right, of the loans. But, you know, it's busy enough that even if you're a really diligent worker, there's no way you can make much of a dent given how much it cost. And so, yeah, we went, you know, kind of from zero to, you know, to full-on debt. Luckily, you know, Texas is not too expensive. So I think, you know, at the end of everything, we were probably each in debt. I was kind of close to 150 and she was kind of close to 200, I think. But, you know, back then, we still at least had some subsidized loans. So at least not every dollar you borrowed was accruing interest from day one like they do now. But yeah, so it was a big change.
And this was, when was medical school, like year-wise? How long
ago
was that?
So I graduated in 2012. So I was the final year to get subsidized loans for grad school.
And it was PSLF had just started at the beginning.
So they had just announced it the year before. So they announced the program in 2007. And so when I started in 2008, everyone knew that it existed. The details were kind of a little bit shoddy back then. I always thought that I would be an academic. So I kind of, you know, I didn't borrow money with the expectation that I wouldn't be paying it back, but I did consider that possibility. And I kind of always treated that idea during residency as I'm going to make sure I'm optimizing for that possibility, because I think it's a really important plan. But I did not count on it. Wasn't like, I'm going to take out extra money and make really bad decisions, knowing that none of it's real. It's all monopoly money. I didn't do that, because that's a fraught way to approach the problem.
Mm-hmm. And so the two of you are finishing medical school. How did the residency and match process happen for you guys?
So we did the couples match. And so we, you know, applied around. The interesting thing about radiology and psychiatry is that radiology has a separate intern year. And so when you do a couples match, you can actually only link up your one program for each person. So I could link up my radiology program with her psychiatry program, but I couldn't include my intern year. And we really did not want to be separated for a year. We had been at this point now together and married for several years. And we just did not want to do long distance ever. And so I ended up going, I think, on more internship interviews than I did radiology interviews, because we really wanted to make sure that every place we interviewed at, I would have at least one or two options for internships. So it was like, okay, we're going to go to Baltimore. I better look at, like, you know, three or four internships there. In the end, we actually had some family health stuff. So we actually came back to Dallas, number one, because we wanted to be near family. And so it ended kind of being a big waste of money and time. Although it was kind of nice to actually see how people do things elsewhere. So I don't regret it, but in the end, we just came back home.
So getting matched wasn't like a a huge deal. You guys got in just fine. And
yeah, we were both very competitive for our field. So it was never really too much of an issue there. The main issue was making sure that I had an internship where I, near where I was going to be practicing. We didn't want to be separated, and that worked out fine too.
Nice. Wow. So really, really no bumps along the road in terms of, you know, just going where you wanted to go and getting matched together. I've seen so many other physician couples where they're doing residencies in different places in country.
It's heartbreaking.
And it's like you're being in the military, you know, you're each getting shipped off to different parts. And you guys didn't experience that at all. What's your take on that? You know, as you look at some of your peers, where that happens?
I think one of the things that happens to a lot of people is this idea of passion or fit, where I think a lot of us have been kind of told that you should find your passion and try to pursue that at all costs. And I think it is a little bit misleading. I don't think most people really have a singular passion where if they don't, you know, do this one specific thing that they're not going to be happy. I think most people could be happy in a lot of different ways. And it's been shown, I think, a lot of studies now that passion is something that often grows over time.
Yeah.
From having a job where you have autonomy and respect and you're able to grow in your role, you know? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I'm a radiologist. If you would ask me as a first year medical student what I wanted to do with my life, I would have said, I don't know, but I know I don't want to do OB-GYN, radiology or pathology. And so here I am. So I was wrong about my passion. And, you know, I don't have a magical appreciation for imaging. I, you know, grew to like it. There are things about it that I like. There are things about it that I don't like. No job is perfect, but I'm very happy in my role right now. So I think some people do get into an idea where they really want to or feel like they should pursue a field that's competitive, that is more competitive, unfortunately, than they are based on their test scores and GPA. And so they ended up having to chase down this kind of geographic arbitrage to get into a field that otherwise they would not compete for. And so it is just a problem with the way we pick doctors, right? Is that when people have fields that are more competitive, we've kind of, in order to weed out people and make it easier for residencies to select applicants, we just make it based on their test scores. Even though your test scores really don't really matter, right? Testing exams were designed to be a kind of A-B pass fail for minimal competency. They were never designed to be like, okay, you got 10 points higher, you have a 270 instead of 260, you're a better human being and a better doctor. I mean, clearly not, right? That is a ludicrous way to approach it, but that's how people do it. And so as a result, you have people who would be great surgeons or great, you know, orthopods or dermatologists, you know, wasting incredible amounts of time and energy and anguish and emotions trying to get their CVs and their test scores pristine, that are basically irrelevant to what they actually will do for the rest of their lives. And it's a sad amount of wasted productivity of taking all these smart students in their 20s and having them waste, you know, countless hours fiddling away and memorizing facts that they will never use that are basically irrelevant to everything they care about. So I think that's a big part of why people get separated and why people kind of struggle in residency is just this issue where there's limited spots and people have this need to do a huge desire to do a certain thing. And so they're unfortunately forced to make consequences and compromises rather about where they'll work and how they'll live in order to have the field they want.
Well, great advice for any medical students or pre-med students that might be listening to the podcast. Wonderful.
It's going to happen.
Right? Totally. Well, I know in my career, I have my day gig and I had been frustrated by all the regulatory stuff around it. And so that's part of the reason why I started doing a bunch of side hustle stuff. And as I tried different things, then I found what I was kind of naturally better at and what was fun. And so I think having that experience, there's nothing like it. And you just have to try things to really figure that out. And like you said, the passion grows too as you get to have more experience with something. So what, Ben, happened with after residency and student loans? You know, what has been you and your wife's approach? Are you doing the same thing, different things? Give us a handle on what's going on there.
So basically the same thing. So it's changed over time. So when we finished school, we, you know, went into income-driven repayment. Back then it was IBR. Then when pay-as-you-earn came out, I switched to pay-as-you-earn. She did not qualify because of her college loans. And then when repay came out, we switched to repay to get the interest subsidy and trying to hedge our bets against the program. In the end, she actually worked part-time in academics, so she did not qualify for PSLF. And then she recently left her practice there to open up a private practice by herself. Mm. And so, and then I work in a private environment, which basically means that I work in a private practice group that has an academic affiliation and a residency program. So even though I teach residents and I work at a teaching hospital, I'm employed by a private group. So neither of us qualify anymore. So we both refinanced our loans since then a couple times, and hers were actually paid off entirely recently. We paid off.
Nice. Awesome. Congrats.
And then I am probably still a couple years away, but I've only been out of fellowship for a year and a half, so I don't feel too bad about it. We're making good progress.
Because she finished before you did, right?
Correct, yeah.
So she got a couple of years on you to knock those out.
Yeah, and we moved houses, had some equity in a prior home, and we kind of had a nice little lump sum from that we were able to deploy as well. So nice. It worked out in our favor. So we've been relatively aggressive, not the kind of super aggressive thing where you move into your parents' basement and eat ramen every day kind of aggressive, but you know, I kind of take a pay yourself first approach to stuff. You know, I don't really care how much I spend on eating out. As long as I'm, you know, funding my retirement and paying off my student loans and putting enough money towards debt and wealth accumulation, I don't really care what I spend elsewhere. We don't really budget from that other perspective. I don't really I look at it, but I don't really have a rule for how much I can spend on Amazon buying stuff I don't really need. I do it all the time. So that's been our approach. So we're making good progress, but it we did owe like, you know, $400,000 though between the two of us when the school was over. So it was kind of, you know, and the number of course grew during residency, even though we were making, you know, our monthly calculated payments, you know, it wasn't enough to mitigate the interest. So it was kind of a very demoralizing process during residency.
Mm-hmm. And tell me a little bit about with making the decision to essentially be in an area where you couldn't get PSLF, you know, were you considering different paths where maybe you could be part of a nonprofit, or was that just not an option? You know, tell us more about that.
Yeah. So when I was in fellowship, I was looking for jobs, and basically we were going to be in Dallas. Matan had a job here. Again, our families are here. And so what I was doing was looking at what was available to me. So in Dallas, there's one nonprofit academic institution, there's a VA, and then there's the group I'm at, and then there's some private practice groups. And so I kind of looked around town, and I didn't really want pure private practice. I didn't really want to be, you know, by myself doing that. The academic institution in town was what I thought I was going to end up sticking around for, but for a variety of reasons, I didn't end up working out. You know, long story short, I think, you know, I'm really into teaching and quality, and they were more interested in me doing more research, and especially they really wanted me to do more training, like an additional fellowship year of research time. Mm. And that's just not my passion. It's not where I want to spend my time. And so this other job I kind of lucked into, I sent in my CV. They weren't hiring, but they hired me anyway. And so I was extremely pleased, right, to have this kind of best of both worlds situation where I can have some time with the residents teaching and being academic, and some time just kind of able to work quietly by yourself and do your other kind of work. And so it's a great mix for me. And so, yeah, it did end up meaning that I had to change my student loan plan. You know, luckily I'm in that family where it's kind of a 1x student loan to income ratio, where, you know, if you owe, you know, twice or more of what you earn per year, it's gonna be really difficult and quite cumbersome to make progress in your loans. It's gonna require a lot of sacrifice. You know, luckily for us, you know, going into state school in Texas, it really wasn't an issue. So, I mean, yeah, it's kind of a bummer to lose out on the forgiveness, but in the long term, my income will be higher anyway in this group, even though during the workup it's not. But the overall job is great. It's a great gig, and I have zero regret about taking it. It has a variety of perks that I could never have had in academics just because of the way the group is structured. That makes it totally worth it for me.
Nice. I love it. Very good. And so you have your blog, benwhite.com, where people can find you. When did that start?
So that started in 2009.
Wow. So you started it in medical school?
Yeah, I actually started it during my first year of medical school. You know, kind of, it was actually the only New Year's resolution I ever kept. I was doing a lot of writing in college, and it was very fulfilling, and I really enjoyed it. And then I got to med school, and I was just taking multiple choice tests, and it was really kind of a bummer. And so I made a resolution that I wanted to write more. I want to write every day, ideally. And so I kind of revamped the site at that point, and it's been in its current iteration since then. So it's been, you know, 11 years now of writing.
What, to keep at it for that long, what do you think's kept you going?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of forever in internet years, right? It's a very long time. I think what I've always tried to do with the site and what keeps it fresh for me is that I don't write about one topic, right? It's not like, you know, drmoneybags.com. It's, you know, it's just me giving my opinion and my thoughts. And so what I've always tried to do is kind of answer my own questions. So when I was in medical school, that was oftentimes, you know, what book should I read? How should I study for this test? What should I do about scheduling my rotations? You know, that kind of stuff. And then it became in residency about how to be a good resident and how to deal with that. And of course, a big part of it ended up being, you know, how do I deal with my finances? How do I deal with student loans as a resident?
Yeah.
And so I've always basically tried to do a ton of research and kind of give a practical, reasonable viewpoint and perspective that's not anonymous, right? So a lot of internet advice is from people on forum posts or Reddit back in the day. And so back when I started writing, you know, 2009, if you Googled a topic about med school, all you'd ever get is anonymous forum posts. You'd never get anything real. Or it'd be some kind of, you know, Blogspot, abandoned Blogspot blog, you know? And so it was kind of unusual back then to be like, this person says this. Super rare back then. And so that's what I've always done. I've always tried to give what I hope is a kind of more reasonable viewpoint. A lot of people who used to write in the space back in the 2009, 2010 kind of area were like it's very gunner mentality is what we used to call it. People who are kind of over the top. You're like, you read their advice and be like, I can't do that. Whatever they're saying is just, it's way too much for a human being to do. I just cannot bear to think about doing that. And so I try to give a kind of more reasonable perspective. So I've been doing that for 11 years, basically.
Wow. And certainly in that time, I believe that was not long after people like the White Coat Investor got started, and people like Jim have really monetized their blog. And I was noticing just as I was scrolling through some of your stories, that doesn't look like something that you've really done. I don't see any ads. I don't see any sort of commercial related stuff on here. Even your book, you're about to give that away for free.
I know. So, I'm a bad business person. It's a terrible side hustle. I mean, so my perspective, and I think part of it has to come from, you know, it being my name, right? Is that I think when you have a commercial site like the White Coat Investor, you know it's a business. You kind of expect a certain level of commercialization. When you have a personal site, even if it becomes popular, it's harder to be like, I'm going to stuff a bunch of ads in here. Because ultimately that reflects on me as a person and as a human, and it kind of colors the advice. You know, I want my writing to be the most important part of people's experience with me. It kind of reflects, you know, my, I don't like the word personal brand, but, you know, personal brand. And so I've been very hesitant whenever I consider adding in anything. And so, you know, I do have some monetization right now. I have Amazon affiliates and stuff like that. So when people buy a book, you know, after visiting my site, I get commission there. You know, I'll sometimes have, you know, coupon codes and discounts for test prep stuff. But it's basically, you know, if I'm going to write about something anyway, there's a way to add in an affiliate link, I'm happy to do it, right? Because it's silly not to. But I never write anything for other companies. I don't do paid reviews. And I definitely don't have any display ads. I had a sponsorship for the book when I first gave it away for free last year. I had a sponsor for a year, and I decided not to renew it because I didn't want anyone to not read it because they felt that it was going to be, you know, cheapened by that process. And so that's also part of the reason why I'm giving it away for free is I just don't want, you know, even right now, you can go to my website at benwhite.com/studentloans and download a copy, but it's been an email giveaway. So you give me your email address and I give it to you with the idea that that one day I would have an email newsletter, which I've never actually started before. So I never send any emails out, but I had this plan. So I've been doing that. And then part of me worries, you know, hey, am I forcing people to not read it because they don't want to, you know, give me their address? And so I'm just making it totally available online. So right now, by the time you listen to this podcast, the whole text will also be available online. So you can download it, you can buy it, you also just read it because, you know, ultimately my goal is to have people get the information that I can provide and hopefully provide value for them. And that is the most important part of the side hustle is that, you know, I can make more money per hour doing more radiology, right? So for me, I mean, passive income is great. I enjoy the money from the website. It's been wonderful. It's definitely not like, you know, white coat investor style, obviously, but it is useful and it makes a big difference. It definitely made a big difference for me when I was a resident, especially, but it's just not the most important part of what I do. And so I kind of always optimized for the reader experience and always optimized for how it reflects on me, I think.
So what would be your advice for someone, because the side hustle thing is something that a lot of us talk about. What's your advice with an 11 years worth of experience, you know, through variety of things? Someone wants to do a podcast or a blog or any kind of side hustle. What are your thoughts on that?
I think my overall thought, and this is a little, maybe a little bit cynical, but is that the goal of a side hustle should be as a creative outlet or, you know, a passion project first and a money-making thing second. I think it's always great to consider, you know, the financial implications, you know, how much money could I make? How easy would it be to monetize? That's fine. But there's no guarantee of money. There's no guarantee of popularity or success. And so if you don't enjoy the process, it probably will fail, right? So most personal websites, most personal blogs like mine are abandoned within around 6 months.
Yeah.
And so I didn't make money, I think, until I'd been doing it for like 2 years. And even then it was not that much, right? And, you know, it happened more later on. And so it's hard to, you know, kind of grow organically. And I think one of the problems now is that it requires a lot of social media stuff that I'm not personally very comfortable with, right? I don't like self-promotion very much. And so, you know, having to go on and comment on every single person's blog that hopefully someone will click on your link and link you back and do tons of guest posts and Twitter and Facebook and Instagram. You know, I like to write. I'm lucky enough that my site came around in an era where you didn't have to do all that to become popular. You could just write a lot of good content and eventually it would all work out. Google would reward you. But now it's hard. And so a lot of the time it has to go towards that part of it too. And so if you enjoy the marketing aspect and you don't enjoy the actual product itself, you don't like making a podcast, you don't like writing, then it's probably not going to work out. And so it's probably not worth doing.
No, I think that's great advice. What I would add to that is I think there's certain side hustles that are meant to make money. Like that's their goal, right? Like if you want to do locums, there's a side hustle. You can make some money immediately. Whereas something like a blog, a podcast, content marketing stuff,
yeah,
it's a lot more difficult and it's much more a passion project. Or if you do some of the stuff I've been doing, land flipping, the goal is to make money. It's not to just do something just for fun. So I think that is kind of the thing I think people miss out on in that process. What do you think? What's your take on
it? Yeah, I agree with that. And I think also what is people miss out on too is that it doesn't have to always make as much money as your primary hustle to be worth it. So, you know, for me, it obviously applies that I make more money doing radiology than I do writing an article, although maybe indirectly it all works out. But, you know, let's say for real estate, you know, you might make more money practicing clinical medicine, but if you find it fun to, in your spare time, do the flips, you know, get into real estate. If you find it, you know, not taxing on your psyche to do that, if you don't mind managing a property, that's great. People always talk about, you know, real estate, like, oh, do you want to be a landlord? I don't want to do that. It's like, yeah, well, if you don't want to do it, don't do it. But if you do enjoy, some people do, then by all means, there's no rule against you spending time in ways that seem like work to other people. I've often always found for me personally that the busier I am, the happier I am, that having more free time, you know, I don't need to watch more TV. It's not going to make me a happier person.
Right.
And so, you know, I'm okay kind of filling the plate pretty high. And so even if that results in me being busier, that's not necessarily a bad thing. And so if you have a side hustle that, you know, makes you less than clinical medicine, but it recharges your battery, it makes you happier, then go for it, right? Like part of the point here is that we don't want to have work-life balance. We want to have work-life harmony. So whatever it takes for you to optimize your income in a way that makes you have a life that you can enjoy day in and day out, that's what you should be going for. If that involves writing, awesome. If it involves real estate, awesome. But if you find your side hustle is draining your battery, it's a terrible side hustle, right?
Yes. Yes. No, absolutely. Life's too short. You never know. Might as well enjoy it. So what do you see, Ben, your future looking like as we look at finances? And obviously you're, as a couple, you're making huge progress towards financial freedom. What does financial freedom look like and mean to you as you march forward?
Yeah, I mean, for us, what we would love to do is be completely debt-free, right? So no student loans, no mortgage, and then kind of really hamp down on making progress towards the kids' eventual education and, you know, kind of shoring up the retirement accounts that we are flexible. I would love to be able to change careers in my 50s instead of later on and do something different or pull back and work more part-time. So, you know, I would love to be a three-day worker and have, you know, 4 days to do other stuff. Mm. And so one of the goals is that when we're debt-free, I'll be able to pull back clinically and work part-time and do kind of more other projects. And it won't matter because we'll have much less, you know, kind of monthly obligations. And so right now we have my student loans and the mortgage and, you know, the kids are still in daycare and whatnot. So it's a pricey lifestyle situation right now. My wife's practiced, you know, she just started her practice a few months ago. So it's still, you know, very fresh, but it's all working out. But so, yeah, we're definitely looking forward to that part of our lives when we're able to kind of try to live a little bit more today instead of just waiting till, you know, we're super old.
Is there some a mentor or a friend or colleague you look at that is doing that right now in terms of the way you guys want to transition? You know, what's that model?
You know, there really isn't one that I know offhand in person. I will say that, you know, my dad is, he's 69 years old. He's still working full time. But I will say, I kind of think I look towards the old school academics as a model, right? There are a lot of guys out there and women who are in academics who kind of grew up in a different era when if you were in an academic position, you kind of had a much easier schedule, fewer patients per day, mm-hmm. You know, a lot of research time where you could, you know, mentor people and do projects. It was much less structured, right, than being in the clinic, 15-minute med check kind of stuff. So when I think about my ideal job and what I want as a kind of working adult later on in my life, I want to have that kind of job where I am working, you know, consistently all the time, but I'm not, you know, working on the clock in the same way where I'm really pounding it, you know, from, you know, 8 to 5, taking call, feeling the pressure to read faster or do more work and take more phone calls. I think that's what I look for is that kind of old school medicine that people used to have back in the day where there was a much better kind of balance to the day and much less clinically dense. That's what I would like to have.
I love it. No, that's great vision. I love where you're going. Any other just kind of closing thoughts or things you want to share, Ben, that we haven't had a chance to cover?
Yes, I just want to reiterate that, you know, if you are currently a person who is in debt or you work with medical students or residents, they obviously have debt, that I do think we do kind of have a student loan crisis in the country, right, where people have now borrowed like $1.6 trillion in student loans. And so I think everyone should try to educate themselves about this topic. It's going to be even more in the news with, you know, the present election stuff and coming laws and the kind of the PSLF era coming up ahead where people are going to get a lot more loans forgiven than they have in the past. So I mm-hmm. think everyone should try to educate themselves about the program and the topics more. And so I did write a book about it. You can download it or view it or whatever you want to at benwhite.com/student loans. Again, totally free. You don't have to give me or do anything, but I do think it's really important information that everybody knows.
Perfect. Perfect. You know, it's interesting. I have yet to actually talk to someone who has had their loans forgiven. Have you talked to anyone that actually won?
Yeah. I mean, the long story of it is that, you know, while the program, technically speaking, matured at 2017 for the first borrowers, based on the requirements, nobody who could have qualified really took the steps they needed to take at that point to qualify then. Very few people. But so my year in 2008, you know, so everyone from my year in medical school had a direct loan because of how the federal government took over student loan funding. Everyone in my year basically went on IBR for repayment, which means they had a qualifying payment plan as well. So now everyone who's working for nonprofit accordingly, who's in my generation, will all qualify after 10 years, as opposed to people right now in the news stories you see with all the clickbait. Everyone getting denied because they didn't follow the rules because they would have had to have taken extra steps to qualify. And no one's that proactive when it comes to this stuff. Half the time the details weren't even clear in the upfront.
Yeah.
So in 2022, especially, you're going to see a massive climb in the approvals. And at that point, we're going to see a lot of really festive news stories, a lot of hand-wringing and discussion, and a lot of clickbait about this program. And so I think we're going to see a lot more people very soon who are qualifying. I'm part of a Facebook group on of PSLF-eligible physicians. And the people who, you know, very shortly, more and more people are going to be qualifying very soon.
Interesting. Yeah, well, this year, I would imagine, there should be that deluge really building.
Yeah, so it's starting as of now.
So, Ben, any other resources you want to drop or things that you think people should check out?
So there is actually one other site I love. It's called doctoredmoney.org. And it's a nonprofit site run by a couple doctors, one of whom is also a financial planner. And they have some really great calculators, especially for kind of calculating different loan payments and plans. And they do a great job. And I think it's a really wonderful resource for helping people kind of get, again, unbiased advice about the topic where they're not going to be, you know, I mean, everyone, there's lots of good content out there, but a lot of content is monetized pretty heavily towards student loan refinancing and other kinds of stuff like that. And there's nothing wrong with any of that. But these guys are even more unbiased than I am. And so I really appreciate what they're doing. They do a great job. They have some very excellent, well-made calculators for helping kind of work through some of the issues yourself.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much, Ben, for being with us. And again, everyone, you can check out his blog at benwhite.com. Thank you, Ben.
Thank you, Dave.
All right, my friends. Well, that wraps up another episode of the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast. Remember to slash your debt, slash your taxes, and live a liberated lifestyle.